It's 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon here at Resonance FM, so here's Late Lunch with Out to Lunch, a programme which hinges on the fact that 3 minutes and 10 seconds into the course of Easy Meat, a notoriously misunderstood track by Frank Zappa, the stentorian baroque parody of Michael Nyman relents and we are suspended for 9 seconds in a peculiar state I'm still looking for concerned interlocutors and non-experts to describe. But it all pulls into insignificance compared to the chronic inability of anyone to tell me why my theme tune appears to be both portentous and vacant. Oh, what a nice little theme tune. Hello, and here's Late Lunch with Out to Lunch. A short theme tune this week, I got a lot to say. This week's episode is called They Make It Trivial, Don't They? In this show, I'm examining the state of contemporary poetry by examining one long poem, a latter-day product of that notorious side stream, or maybe Oxbow Lake, called Cambridge poetry. Like viewing a liquid pipetted onto specially absorptive paper in what they call chromatography, this lengthy spread might allow us to detail and specify the undergirding tensions of an entire social layer. Absence of editing here at Resonance, apart from the ban on four-letter words, of course, means I can say what I like about any poet I please. But bear in mind that I'm trying to diagnose the morbidities of an entire profession, not just damn one particular soul. First, though, we're going to listen to the opposite. It always upset me that Derek Bailey talked about Archie Shepp in the most disparaging terms. Granted, Shepp's genius is theatrical and political, while Bailey demanded a musician's music above all. Nevertheless, the way Bailey and Braxton bonded in their contempt for Archie Shepp's extrovert and saleable militancy seemed to me to shirk the oral evidence of the records. The Art Ensemble of Chicago were indeed a bunch of talentless chancers, the Mekons of their day, but Shepp was a great arranger in the Illington-Mingus line. His sound on tenor is unmistakable, and even when he's coasting on ballads and blues, he cuts great albums. It makes me wonder if Braxton's animosity wasn't just that of a political enemy, someone who preferred mysticism to struggle, maybe coupled with jealousy that another free jazzer made a bigger splash than he in Paris in 1969. Shepp's unusual combination of polemic and publicity do recall Frank Zappa, and it's appropriate that he was once Zappa's guest on stage. There are some other uncanny correspondences too, not to say morphic resonances, which I'm only just beginning to discern. So, to forearm ourselves against the political dejection of latter-day Cambridge poetry, let's listen to Archie Shepp in 1975, recording in the wake of the Portuguese Revolution and the freeing of Mozambique from the colonial yoke. To me, this conveys what sort of music could be like, provided we had egos tough enough to face the history being made under our noses.
Is heard. It begins with an African word. It's as heavy as stone. It is never alone. But there's some folks If you've never been there, hear my song. Tell the people of Earth to be strong. You're as heavy as stone. You are never alone. But there's some folks who never have heard.
Play that banjo, black boy. It's the sound music makes your soul leap for joy. Shout, Uhuru, while mute Perugia stands sunk in a sea of faces uplifted, singing. Today, Uhuru, oh yeah, freedom, later they tell us, but we know the time is now. Sow your harvest, mother, weep no more, reap thy bitter crop, my father. Rhyme poem, nigger ain't no more, he's black, that's sure. That stole from me that whole world, a mystery I knew. Blow, Brother John, sweet memory, be a living thing.
Sunk in a sea of faith, uplifted,
Archie Shepp and A Song for Mozambique, a tune by Semenya McCord. During its course, Shepp recited a poem he'd written which named the album A Sea of Faces. The LP was released by Black Saint in 1975. You heard drummer Beaver Harris on tambourine and vocals, the singing voices of Bunny Foy and Rafi Taha, Archie Shepp playing his soprano sax and reciting poetry, Dave Burrell on piano, Cameron Brown on bass and trombonist Charles Greenlee on yet more vocals. But let's return from the unguarded excesses of collective, polybabbling, revolutionary love to the ruling individualist meanness which claims all authority, truth and stipends for itself. I'm talking about The Unconditional by Simon Jarvis, a great white slab of Cambridge poetry which has had all the epigones twittering its praises since it was published by Bark Press in 2005. I've only recently sat down to read it through, and I emerge withered and ashamed, almost disgusted to have ever had anything to do with this genre of pipsqueak preening. In terms of emotive effect and political tendency, The Unconditional has got about as much to do with Prynne and Raworth's late 60s psychedelic cascade as Otomo Yoshihide has to do with Masayuki Takeyanagi, i.e. bugger all. Excuse my French, as my father used to say. I must admit that I'm feeling fit and ready for combat at the moment. At the end of May, Uncant is publishing Adorno for Revolutionaries, a collection of my polemics on music and cultural studies. The volume was edited by Andy Wilson, with whom I formed the Association of Musical Marxists last December. Adorno for Revolutionaries happens to contain a review of Simon Jarvis's book on Adorno, a howl of rage from me, which got me into trouble in the pages of the journal Historical Materialism. Now, despite his reduction of Adorno to yet another continental philosophy flounderer, I was prepared to give Jarvis's poetry a chance. I didn't buy The Unconditional just to trash it. In fact, while it slumbered unopened on the shelf, I nurtured vague hopes that Simon had left behind his day job and forged something rich and strange. Here was someone whose thesis on sculptor Brian Catling tweezed my brain at the second Cambridge Conference of Contemporary Poetry back in 1992, and these tweezers amplified the buzz of reading Ian Sinclair when he started becoming a household name. When I told Jarvis I wanted to read Hegel, we sat together one summer afternoon in a Cambridge college garden among flowers and butterflies, and he dictated from heart the names of various basic English translations. The scribbled list I made helped me on my way. Jarvis's insistence that literary criticism should concentrate on prosody, how works affect us materially outside any generic rules, is one I like and apply. I also know Simon's a Fall fan. I once suggested to Simon that we pursue Mark E. Smith for a two-headed interview. He looked horrified. But I did have hopes for The Unconditional. But what I found in its pages is a shocking example of the cynicism, nihilism and silliness at the numb heart of the academic humanities, especially in Cambridge, where the pressure to be intelligent and critical seems to blind thought the elemental stupidities – need, greed, money, lust, necessity – which make it fully part of the mass it thinks it rises above. Jarvis is a Catholic Tory, forced by the injustices of a history he can't understand to master insurgent philosophies he can't abide. When it hit the Cambridge scene in the early 90s, the polemic adumbrated by Jarvis and his colleague Drew Milne was that the poet's retrograde hippie remnant of 67 counterculture had to get up to speed with the Frankfurt School, even up to and including Jürgen Habermas, whom no one in England had heard of yet. But when Jarvis is allowed to run free in a 200-page poem with neither formal constraints nor modernist fury at formal constraints, it emerges that Jarvis would much rather not be bothered with Hegel and Marx and Adorno. These writers seem to force him to think in a way that's painful to his specious class being, which remains quietistic, diffident and reactionary. So I find myself in the strange position of an amateur, if that means unfunded, philosopher, insisting on the relevance of thought and philosophy versus a professional who, using poetic license, of course, continually finds philosophical axioms and disputes useless, ridiculous, embarrassing and whatever. Let's forget Hegel and Adorno. The real issue here is Marx. In other words, the connection Marx forged between philosophy and politics, between ideas and everyday life. Those intent on justifying the current order decry Marxism as blind prejudice applied to a world which should be reviewed with an open heart and an open mind. But Marxism isn't prejudice. It's simply a set of intellectual propositions and criticisms which destroys 99% of the tenets of public opinion. When J.H. Prynne published Brass in 1971, his readings of Asger Jorn and Guy Debord, writers steeped in Marx, reached the somnolent veil of English poetry like a blowtorch on an anthill, scattering flaming chitin all over the shop. The scorched heath left by Brass attracted many campers, all wanting to build their own weirdly intricate igloos on its tabula rasa. Unfortunately, the unconditional is the humorous squib about the resulting confusion which appeared in Punch, snickering at the inability of igloists to construct decent suburban semi-Ds out of scrap iron, polystyrene chips and horse muck. It's not building anything itself at all. But maybe this is all just because I'm a bit slow and socialist and stupid, and thought that Hegel made a devastating criticism of Kant, and that Marx demonstrated that Hegel was talking about capitalism when Hegel thought he was talking about spirit. I actually think there's a sequence to philosophical arguments that real thinkers get somewhere. So it shocks me that someone who claims to be conversant with Hegel and Adorno can say things like, "or any other pattern in the stars, since patterning is only from ourselves." Now, of course, poetry isn't theory. In fact, The Unconditional frequently resembles a comic novel, with characters spouting spoofs of intellection which fall custard pie-like onto the sawdust. But I don't think Jarvis wrote those lines in order to ridicule someone who hasn't got Hegel's Kant critique. I think he says them in all sincerity. Jarvis's prosody in The Unconditional echoes that of T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, the sound of someone rehearsing thought processes with an eye to applause. But Jarvis never keeps anything up, forever capsizing his own blank verse into unmetrical phrases of abject banality. Presumably he thinks these moments of bathos are radical, like bad painting in Magritte's Vache period, or Asger Jorn's ugly paint strokes, or Jeff Koons' kitsch figurines. But I hear only the nervous titter of a careerist who resents all verbal music, all art, since such appeals to subjectivity might hinder efficiency in competing for a slice of the pie. So despite his claimed fluency with Hegel and Adorno, Jarvis thinks all patterns perceived in the world are projected on random data by the mind. So he can't get beyond Kant. In Marx's terms, he's an idealist. This doesn't mean someone who fights for ideals. It means someone utterly confused by the appearance of the modern world and unable to find a way out. If people are going to talk about Adorno and dialectics, they need to examine revolutions and writers committed to revolution. It was not for nothing that Hegel greeted the French Revolution of 1789 with enthusiasm. Inexplicably for a reader of Adorno, whose negative dialectics was an attempt to wrest dialectics from its use as state ideology in the USSR, Jarvis's dialectic is actually Stalinist. Three times over, The Unconditional brings up quantity into quality. This Stalinist cliché, taught in 1,000 communist educationals, contends that the prime example of dialectics is quantity into quality, and that this transformation of one concept into another, so hard for the analytic mind to grasp, is best illustrated by watching a boiling kettle. More heat, and more quantity, then the water boils, quantity turns into quality, and we get steam. There are leaps in nature. Everything isn't a seamless grey mediocrity. Fair enough. Unfortunately, once established as the sole image of the dialectic, the boiling kettle conveys a reactionary message. Steam versus water becomes a rerun of the Christian Neoplatonic vaunting of spirit over matter, projecting in-place social hierarchies onto physical processes. As a science of extracting value from the working class, capitalist economics employs the same dialectic. Quantity is the mass of people working every day, us. Quality, the surplus value shareholders can extract. Next step, quality circles, and excellence exemplified by the warm wheat roll available in an expensive restaurant in St. Pancras Station. It shocked me to read it first, but the revolutionary dialectic actually reverses the quantity into quality model. A left activist in Detroit, Rhea Dunayevskaya, decided to go beyond Bolshevism by returning to Hegelian philosophy. And she made a fantastic discovery. Quantity into quality is banal, said Hegel. The really amazing thing is quality into quantity. As usual, dialectics only make sense when you apply it to something concrete. So we shall. An individual, says Dunayevskaya, is a quality, a unique and solitary phenomenon. But something special happens in society. You get a quantity of individuals. I'll quote her very words. She's glossing Hegel's science of logic on quality, quantity and measure. Hegel explains how quality turns into its opposite, quantity. And this isn't a falling off or dumbing down. It's actually a progressive development. Dunayevskaya says, quality, a someone, something. The emperor, the king, the one. People sometimes think that quantity is below quality. No, it's above it, because before you had only one, and now you have many. You have some democracy. Don't forget, Hegel's theory always starts at 500 BC. 500 BC is 500 years before Christ. Dostoevsky is talking about the ancient Athenians and their discovery of democracy and the intimate connection between real philosophy, the pursuit of truth, and non-hierarchical discussion between equals. Dostoevsky spoke these words in Tokyo in January 1966, addressing Zenshin, a grouping of the Japanese New Left. That year also saw the appearance of Freakout, Frank Zappa's vehicle for dialectics in the realm of the capitalist entertainment industry. Later on, with Zappa's knack for stating philosophical truths in language anyone can understand, he made the same point as Dostoevsky. Zappa was comparing a dance contest at the New York Palladium during his show. A mumbling man, a contestant from the audience, says, "Ugliness, ugliness." In response, Zappa decided to make an announcement about aesthetics.
Like you, my buddy!
All right, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I have an important message to deliver to all the cute people all over the world. If you're out there and you're cute, maybe you're beautiful, I just want to tell you something. There's more of us ugly motherfuckers than you are. Hey, so watch out.
Apologies for the use of a bad word there, but I think in context, Zappa's humorous use of it can't really offend anybody. One can only add, in the light of the foregoing discussion of Simon Jarvis's The Unconditional, that the beautiful souls of post-Pridian poetry better watch out too. There's more of us than you are. Jarvis rehearses the paradox of being a lone critical intellectual, a quality without quantity, by including a question. How can a critical intellectual use the very terms that she at once subjects to searching criticism? Jarvis's answer, the same way I fall asleep when you talk. Here, Jarvis's rediscovery of his body is selective. It asserts itself whenever he feels he's under attack. The jibe reveals he really finds Hegel, Marx and Adorno acutely boring and would rather not be bothered by their arguments. Having turned his reading matter into a profession, he finds he can't stand it. He has no inkling that for less privileged souls, Hegel, Marx and Adorno might explain why money isn't a fair exchange for their time and why paid labour entails exploitation, alienation, frustration, war and so on. These writers might explain our lives and our society to us. True, The Unconditional isn't burdened by old-wave pieties, humbug or pretension. In fact, it's full of jokes, but they're all bathos and self-hatred. Jarvis's tittering sense of futility can't credit any social role for his intellect, while his quantity into quality dialectic blinds him to the answer. Because being a solitary critical intellectual is indeed pointless, absurd, depressing, stupid and silly. It's when you meet another wretch who is as negative as you about everything that the thunder rolls and the lightning crashes and real life starts, because genuine communication has started. This is the electric contact that brought Marx and Engels together and made the Communist Manifesto blaze over the centuries. It's the revolutionary point of the turning world. It's what leads to trade unions and workers' parties and avant-garde art movements, and it's entirely dependent on quantity. To take the example of Adorno, someone both Jarvis and I talk about a lot. Without quantity, Adorno would be nothing. It was the noisy debates with Benjamin, Brecht, Bloch, Horkheimer and Lukács which generated his best ideas. And none of them would be worth the time of day were it not for the ever-humming background argument that only a quantity of revolutionary thinkers, united in a party, can change the world. Without Lenin, all their arguments degenerate into the usual bohemian whinge, as academia and art and the art scene bear witness. Residence listeners know it. We suffer their guff all the time on this wavelength. A good test of someone's ability to bypass the idiocy of public opinion is 9/11, and Jarvis fails spectacularly. In The Unconditional, 9/11 isn't an opportunity to discuss American foreign policy, new forms of war and propaganda, or the history of espionage, or of religious fundamentalism and its exploitation by the CIA, or anything that concrete or interesting. No, 9/11 is a green light for metaphysical speculation, as empty as it's banal. Perhaps perfect hatred, wonders Jarvis, being perfect, could be good. This simply recalls Anselm's ontological proof of God, and to no end. But what ensues from perfect hatred, Jarvis notes, is miserable. Ah, yes, violence is nasty. A sonnet that Prynne used to set for undergraduates, Shakespeare's They That Have Power to Hurt and Will Do None, pops up all over The Unconditional. suitably the line encodes an ethic only ruling class personnel might aspire to. Think about it, those that have power to hurt and will do none. And of course, we have to plough through the usual paradoxes of middle class guilt. You cannot choose but munch another's flesh. Well, you could choose to band together with other critical intellectuals and try and do something different, Simon. Not just because you ought to, either. Wouldn't it be more fun than trivialising and blocking the best of human thought from epoch to epoch? Maybe we should coin a term for this poetic marathon and its ilk, Prynism. Not using J.H. Prynne's increasingly outlandish nonsense to blow up rutinous boredom and re-lighten our grip on language, but instead fantasising celestial hierarchies of achieved reputation and a star place in the archive. A secular inglit version of pious Catholics dreaming of a seat next to God's right hand. Here, work on the words themselves is abandoned for narcissistic reverie. Rather than launcher of missiles programmed to explode on contact with identity thinking, Prynne becomes a pope or laureate, someone to supplant. This is like that crew of lightweight pimple brains who worship Frank O'Hara. Let me have a career in arts management and still be cool, oh please. I mean, of course the burning words only arrive from those who live their lives right, but as soon as you start judging people by their acts rather than reflecting on their words, you're casting nets of morality which never keep the good fish in and the bad fish out. Damn ethics. Only focus on the verbal object gives criticism clarity, a chance of communication and democratic debate, rather than self-advancement by other abasement. Interestingly enough, there's a text by Adorno which has already denounced the unconditional. It's the 10 Theses on the Philosophy of Language I was talking about on this show last week. Jarvis's idealism makes him divorce form from content, which for a poet, someone attempting to mint phrases of absolute worth, is tantamount to suicide. Hence the perpetual recurrence of bathos and self-defeating jokes in the unconditional. This or that content fills up any jar, he says, and just add content to the crunchy tank. If Nazi concentration camp guards listen to Schubert, it's not to do with capitalist exploitation alienating us from the products of our significant labours. It's because anyone can listen to Schubert stupidly. Back, of course, to the Cambridge delusion, forever echoing T.S. Eliot's asinine slogan, there's no method except to be very intelligent. I mean the delusion that sheer intelligence and excellence are solutions, when really they're just descriptors of ready-made value, and know nothing about the dirty task of dealing with social materials and making historical decisions, i.e. know nothing of either productive labour or political action. In his 10 Theses, Adorno proposed an aesthetic solution to philosophical language. This can only be understood by considering the debates about art and the Germany he just fled from. When he says, today the philosopher confronts disintegrated language, and that the method should be configurative, you need to bear in mind Walter Benjamin's remarks on Dada. When Adorno says, genuine art today no longer has the character of the metaphysical, but rather turns itself in unmediated fashion towards the presentation of actual contents of being, he means that a Kurzschwitter's rubbish collage is more beautiful than an idealised watercolour landscape, which it is. Moreover, aiding the tendency of this particular polemic, Adorno's turn towards unmediation is a blow against the Cambridge teak, which always finds lack of attention to mediation the primal sin of lay and red brick uni stupidity. Rattle a Cambridge don, and he reaches for his mediating reflectors. Back in 1993, I enthused to J.H. Prynne about iced tea. Like Frank Zappa, by the way, he shot back, all that street stuff, it's highly orchestrated and staged. Zappa's words to me were, iced tea's an actor. But Prynne had the nous to consult his daughter about gangster rap and came back chastened, admitting there was something to iced tea that was bracing and real once he'd listened to it. Calling for the need to mix real-world objects in amongst the intellectual critique, Adorno can't be recruited to the lazy, it's always more complex than that, of pretend critique. It's where you make it more simple than it was when you started that you've achieved a genuine begriff, a genuine notion, a genuine concept. If the unconditional has an enemy, it's not capitalism, since we're all guilty and it can't be located, but the active left. With their shouting and noise, these simpletons make Jarvis's life uncomfortable. So there's two pages of sneers at communism. These have nothing to do with deploring the authoritarian regimes which fell in 1989, but everything to do with scorning youthful hope and anti-capitalist rage. These lines could easily come from the cantos. So we're left wondering where Jarvis's ungrounded insistence on good thoughts is going to go next, politically speaking. Now, as ever on Late Lunch, I'm talking personally. My argument is that the conservative and fascistic impulses of abstract rationality will only ever be defeated by using the embodiment of unreason in the fabric of production, which is to say, pop culture. By using, I don't mean the postmodern worship of success and market penetration. I mean an absurd delight in how odd these calcifications of the human spirit actually are. I'm arguing that we should all become speleologists of the stalactites and stalagmites and rippled stone curtains beneath our lordly shoes. Because it can't be done by the solitary intellectual. The complex productions of the culture industry require collective analysis, as improvised as it is uneven. Here's a segue of six songs demanding some kind of intelligent reply. I don't know the exact answer yet, but I'm convinced that their alignment begs a question.
My sweet Lady Jane, when I see you again, your servant am I, and will humbly remain. Just heed this plea, my love, on bended knees, my love, I pledge myself to Lady Jane. My dear Lady Anne, I've done what I can. I must take my leave, for promised I am. Run, my love, your time has come, my love, I pledge my troth to Lady Jane. I wait at your ease. The sands have run out for your lady and me. Wedlock is nigh, my love, her station's right, my love, life is secure with Lady Jane.
Thank you. I am his new queen sister. special delivery, registered mail. You're gonna have to sign for this, buddy. Come on out, you little sumbitch. I know you're in there. Goddamn little communist.
So what?
the Joe Cuba Sextet on Tico Records in 1966. That sequence of tracks, designed to demonstrate that what you may think of as Latin American music, be that bossa nova or samba or salsa, is actually the commodification of carnival and tense with contradiction. From the top, you heard Mick Jagger in best doublet and hose new Elizabethan dandy vein, Lady Jane from Aftermath, a Decca LP release from 1966. The close miking of the strings has the kind of edge no one but Eugene Shadbourne seems capable of today. All because Dave Hassinger, the sound engineer, who Andrew Lug Oldham poached from Jack Nietzsche, didn't know quite what the Stones was going to spring on him next. Acoustic guitar, electric guitar, sitar, harpsichord, or, as he puts it in the sleeve notes, or anything else that happens to be lying around. It's easy to tell when the engineer knows exactly what everyone's doing. It makes boring-sounding records, the documentary frisson of mechanical reproductions sacrificed to musical concepts. Then you heard Panda Go Panda. In the English edition of the film, it's titled as it says, but Co-Panda actually means baby panda because it's to do with a father panda and a baby panda who make friends with Mimiko, a little girl. So it's a kind of Finnegan's Wake-style translation of the Japanese word into something that fits in English too. So Panda Go Panda, the theme song of Hayao Miyazaki's first foray into cartoons, originally made for TV, where a Japanese studio orchestra stumbled on a similar freshness as the Rolling Stones, I think, through sheer exuberance and absence of models. Making children's music wasn't some join-the-dots, contract-bound deal like in Walt Disney. It was an open book to scribble on with the brightest of sounds, in this case achieving a kind of Latin march music. Or was that mariachi? Or maybe being Miyazaki of the endless progressive politics matriarchy? Panda Go Panda came out in 1972. Then you heard Hello, Hello, Daddy, I'll Sacrifice You, the last track of Bow Wow's Sea Jungle, Go Join Your Gang, Yeah, Go Ape Crazy LP from 1981, an item of great anthropological interest, Malcolm McLaren's research into mating rituals fed into the anxious jaws of the living beast. Then you heard Frank Zappa's nod to the Cuban riff ever exploited by Ray Manzarek of The Doors, his guitar solo, a kind of tantrum against Jim Morrison's idea of cool, leading into Drafted Again, written after President Jimmy Carter said he wanted to bring back conscription. My idea was that Zappa's dissolution of proper rock music into a plethora of discordant voices might prepare your ears to hear the Joe Cuba Sextet as less a Cuban rock classic than a load of noisy shouting, which is what Carnival actually is. Oh, wish Gamma was here to snork with me.
Come with it, get it! Come get it! I'm with it, baby!
And that leaves us. I'm sorry I sped things up during that because I wanted to play the complete Moaning by Charles Mingus from his Blues and Roots LP.
Thank you.
Wow, what a mighty machine is a really swinging jazz band. That was Charles Mingus, who knew a lot about folding gospel verities into shiny New York art product. Moaning with Pepper Adams on unmissable, snorting, snorking baritone sax, plus Jimmy Nepper and Willie Dennis on trombones, Jack McLean and John Handy on alto saxes. I think that was John Handy who did the solo. Booker Irvin on tenor sax, Horace Parlan on piano and Danny Richmond on drums. And Charles Mingus, of course, was playing bass. That was recorded in New York on the 4th of February 1959 by Tom Dowd and released by Atlantic on Mingus's Blues and Roots album. OK, that's the end of this edition of Late Lunch with Out to Lunch, which was called They Make It Trivial, Don't They? If you like what you heard, please tune in here at Resonance 104.4 FM next Wednesday at 2. But if you're impatient for more or would like to get in touch, please call at the Uncant website. That's un as in unlikely and cant as in the philosopher. This is Ben Watson saying goodbye. Goodbye. The engineer is telling me to provide some patter. Oh, they'd like some more music. Well, we could listen to Bang Bang by the Joe Cuba Sextet that I sped up earlier.